This is Audible.
Audible Inc. presents Millionaire Teacher, The 9 Rules of Wealth You Should Have Learned in School. Written by Andrew Hallam. Narrated by Peter Drew. Rule 1. Spend like you want to grow rich. I wasn't rich as a 30-year-old. Yet, if I wanted to, I could have leased a Porsche, borrowed loads of money for an expensive flashy home, and taken 5-star holidays around the world. I would have looked rich, but instead, I would have been living on an umbilical cord of bank loans and credit cards. Things aren't always what they appear to be. In 2004, I was tutoring an American boy in Singapore. His mom dropped him off at my house every Saturday. She drove the latest Jaguar, which in Singapore would have cost well over $250,000. Cars in Singapore are very expensive. They lived in a huge house, and she wore an elegant Rolex watch. I thought they were rich. After a series of tutoring sessions, the woman gave me a check. Smiling, she gushed about her family's latest overseas holiday and expressed how happy she was that I was helping her son. The check she wrote was for $150. Climbing on my bicycle after she left, I pedaled down the street and deposited the check in the bank. But here's the thing. The check bounced. She didn't have enough money in her account. This could, of course, happen to anyone. With this family, however, it happened with as much regularity as a Kathmandu power outage. Dreading the phone calls where she would implore me to wait a week before cashing the latest check finally took its toll, and I eventually told her that I wouldn't be able to tutor her son anymore. Was this supposed to be happening? After all, this woman had to be rich. She drove a Jaguar. She lived in a massive house. She wore a Rolex. Her husband was an investment banker who should have been doing the backstroke in the pools of money he made. It dawned on me that she might not have been rich at all. Just because someone collects a large paycheck and lives like Persian royalty doesn't necessarily mean he or she is rich. The Hippocratic Rule of Wealth. If we're interested in building wealth, perhaps we should all make a pledge to ourselves, much like a doctor's Hippocratic Oath. Above all, do no harm. We're living in an era of instant gratification. If we want to communicate with someone half a world away, we can do that immediately with a text message or a phone call. If we want to purchase something and have it delivered to our door, it's possible to do that with a mobile phone and a credit card number, even if we don't have the money to pay for it. Just like that seemingly wealthy American family in Singapore, it's very easy to harm our financial future by blowing money we don't even have. The story of living beyond one's means can be heard around the world. To stay out of harm's way financially, we need to build assets, not debts. One of the surest ways to build wealth over a lifetime is to spend far less than you make and intelligently invest the difference. But too many people hurt their financial health by failing to differentiate between their wants and their needs. Many of us know people who landed great jobs right out of college and started down a path of hyper-consumption. It usually began innocently. Perhaps with their handy credit cards, they bought a new dining room table. But then their plates and cutlery didn't match, so they had to upgrade. Then there's the couch, which now doesn't jive with the fine dining room table. Thank God for a Visa. Time for a sofa upgrade. It doesn't take long, however, before our friends notice the carpet doesn't match the new couch. So they scour advertisements for a deal on a Persian beauty. Next, they're dreaming about a new entertainment system, then a home renovation, followed by the well-deserved trip to Hawaii. Rather than living the American dream, they're stuck in a mythological Greek nightmare. Zeus punished Sisyphus by forcing him to continually roll a boulder up a mountain, only to have it maddeningly roll back every time it neared the summit. Many consumers face the same relentless treadmill with their consumption habits. When they get close to paying off their debts, they reward themselves by adding weight to their Sisyphean stone, which knocks them back to the base of their own daunting mountain. Buying something after saving for it instead of buying it with a credit card is so 1950s. At least that's how many consumers see it. As a result, the 21st century has brought mountains of personal debt that often gets pushed under the rug. Before we learn to invest to build wealth, we have to learn how to save. If we want to grow rich on a middle-class salary, we can't be average. We have to sidestep the consumption habits to which so many others have fallen victim. According to the Wall Street Journal, the average U.S. household in 2010 was strapped with $7,490 in credit card debt. A Huffington Post business article reported in 2011 that 23% of Americans owed more money on their mortgages than their homes were actually worth. In Nevada, 66% of homeowners could sell their houses and still not have enough money to pay off their mortgages. Now here's where things get interesting. You might assume it's mostly low-salaried workers who overextended themselves. But consider this. According to U.S. author and wealth researcher Thomas Stanley, who has been surveying America's affluent since 1973, most U.S. homes valued at $1 million or more, as of 2009, were not owned by millionaires. Instead, the majority of million-dollar homes were owned by non-millionaires with large mortgages and very expensive tastes. In sharp contrast, 90% of those who met the defined criterion to be a millionaire, having a net worth of more than $1 million, lived in homes valued at less than $1 million. If there were such a thing as a financial Hippocratic Oath, many people would be committing malpractice on themselves. It's fine to spend extravagantly if you're truly wealthy, but regardless of how high people's salaries are, if they can't live well without their job, then they aren't truly rich. How would I define wealth? It's important to make the distinction between real wealth and a wealthy pretense so that you don't get sucked into a lifestyle led by the wealthy pretenders of the world. Wealth itself is always relative. But for people to be considered wealthy, they should meet the following two criteria. 1. They should have enough money to never have to work again, if that's their choice. 2. They should have investments, a pension, or a trust fund that can provide them with twice the level of their country's median household income over a lifetime. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, the median U.S. household income in 2009 was $50,221. Based on my definition of wealth, if an American's investments can annually generate twice that amount, $100,442 or more, then that person is rich. Earning twice as much money as the median household in your home country without having to work is a financial luxury many people can only dream about. How do investments generate enough cash? Because this book will focus on building investments using the stock and bond markets, let's use a relative example. If John builds an investment portfolio of $2.5 million, then he could feasibly sell 4% of that portfolio each year, equating to roughly $100,000 annually, and never run out of money. If his investments are able to continue growing by 6 to 7% a year, he could likely afford, over time, to sell slightly more of his investment portfolio each year to cover the rising costs of living. If John were in this position, I would consider him wealthy. If he also owned a Ferrari and $1 million home, then I'd consider him extremely wealthy. But if John had an investment portfolio of $400,000, owned $1 million home with the help of a large mortgage, and leased a Ferrari, then I would suggest that John wasn't rich at all, even if his take-home pay was $600,000 a year. I'm not suggesting that we live like misers and save every penny we earn. I've tried that already, as I'll share with you, and it's not much fun. But if we want to grow rich, we need to have a purposeful plan. And watching what we spend so we can invest money is an important first step. If wealth building were a course that everyone took, and if we were graded on it every year, even after high school, do you know who would fail the course miserably? Professional basketball players. Most National Basketball Association, NBA players, make millions of dollars a year. But are they rich? Most of them seem to be. But it's not how much money you make that counts, it's what you do with what you make. According to a 2008 Toronto Star article, a NBA Players Association representative visiting the Toronto Raptors team once warned the players to temper their spending by reminding them that 60% of retired NBA players go broke 5 years after they stop collecting their enormous NBA paychecks. How can that happen? Sadly, the average NBA basketball player has very little, if any, financial common sense. Why would he? High schools don't prepare us for the financial world. By following the concepts of wealth in this book, you can work your way toward financial independence. With a strong commitment to the rules, you could even grow wealthy, truly wealthy. This starts by following the first of my 9 wealth rules. Spend like you want to be rich. By minimizing the purchases that you don't really need, you can maximize your money for investment purposes. Of course, that's often easier said than done when you see so many others purchasing things that you would like to have as well. Instead of looking where you think the grass is greener, admire your own yard and compare it, if you must, to my father's old car. Doing so can build a foundation of wealth. Let me explain how it worked for me. Can you see the road when you're driving? Riding shotgun as a 15-year-old in my dad's 1975 Datsun, I thought we were traveling a bit fast. I leaned over to look at the speedometer and noticed that it didn't work. "Dad," I asked, "how do you know how fast you're going if your speedometer doesn't work?" My dad asked me to lift up the floor mat beneath my feet. "Fold it back," he grinned. There was a fist-sized hole in the floor beneath my feet, and I could see the rushing road below. "Who needs a speedometer when you can get a better feel for speed by looking at the road?" he told me. The following year, when I turned 16, I bought my own car with cash that I had saved from working at a supermarket. It was a 6-year-old 1980 Honda Civic. The speedometer worked, and best of all, there wasn't a draft at my feet. Because it was the nicest car in the family, I always felt like I was riding in style, which leads me to one of the greatest secrets of wealth building. Your perceptions dictate your spending habits. The surest way to grow rich over time is to start by spending a lot less than you make. If you can alter your perspective to be satisfied with what you have, then you won't be as tempted to blow your earnings. You'll be able to invest money over long periods of time, and thanks to the compounding miracles of the stock market, even middle-class wage earners eventually can amass sizable investment accounts. Thanks to my dad's car, which also leaked, I felt rich because I had a roadworthy steed that didn't leak from the roof and windows when it rained. Instead of comparing my car with those that were newer, faster, and cooler, I viewed my dad's car, which you could start with a screwdriver in the ignition slot, as the comparative benchmark. Buddhists believe that wanting leads to suffering. In the case of the boy I tutored in Singapore, the family's seemingly insatiable appetite for fine things will likely lead to a degree of suffering, especially if the head of the family loses his job or wants to retire. It reminds me of a bumper sticker I once saw, parodying the infamous line of Snow White's dwarves, I-O, it's off to work I go. Why the aspiring rich should drive rich people's cars. If you want to give yourselves decent odds at growing rich, you don't have to drive a piece of junk. Where's the fun in that? How about driving the sort of car driven by the average U.S. millionaire? At first, it might sound counterproductive to dole out many tens of thousands of dollars for a BMW, Mercedes-Benz, or Ferrari while expecting to grow rich. But most millionaires might surprise you with their taste in cars. In 2009, the median price paid for a car by U.S. millionaires was $31,367 U.S. Forget about expensive European darlings such as BMW, Mercedes-Benz, and Jaguar as the favorite steeds of the rich. When Thomas Stanley polled U.S. millionaires, the most popular brand of car was the humdrum Toyota. Many of the wannabe rich try to outdo their peers in the car spending department, easily parting with $40,000 and upward on a luxury cruiser, compared with the $31,367 the average U.S. millionaire pays. But how can you build wealth and reduce financial stress when you're paying far more for a car than an average millionaire? It's like trying to keep up with a pack of Olympic sprinters, but giving them a 50-meter head start. Image is nothing if you lose your job, can't make your car payments, or if you're stuck having to work until you're 80 years old. If you want to keep pace with the millionaires, begin on the start line or give yourself the biggest lead you can. It doesn't make sense to spend more than most rich people do on a set of wheels. Paying more for a car than a deca-millionaire. In 2006, Warren Buffett, one of the three richest men in the world, bought the most expensive car he has ever owned, a $55,000 Cadillac. The average deca-millionaire, a person with a net worth of more than $10 million, paid $41,997 for his or her latest car. If you find yourself in an upscale mall, check out the parking lot and you'll see many vehicles worth more than $41,997. Some will even be worth more than Warren Buffett's car. But how many of the car owners do you think have $10 million or more? If your answer is probably none, then you're catching on fast. Many have jeopardized their own pursuit of wealth or financial independence for the illusion of looking wealthy instead of being wealthy. Whatever money you save on a car, not to mention the savings from interest payments if you can't buy the car outright, can go toward wealth-building investments. Cars aren't investments. Unlike long-term assets such as real estate, stocks, and bonds, cars depreciate in value with each passing year. One of the savviest guys I ever met and his view on buying cars. When I was 20 years old, I took a summer job washing buses at a bus depot to pay for my college tuition. What I learned there from an insightful mechanic was more valuable than anything I learned at college. Russ Perry was a millionaire mechanic raising two kids as a single dad. His financial acumen was revered by the other mechanics, who told me, "Hey, if Russ ever wants to talk to you about money, make sure you listen." We worked the night shift together, which wasn't particularly busy, especially on weekends, so we had plenty of time to talk. My job was pretty simple. I washed buses, fueled them, and recorded their mileage at the end of the day. During my free moments at work, I alternated between cringing and laughing out loud when Russ sermonized about money and people. Not everything Russ had to say was politically correct, but his crassness always had an element of truth to it. Russ claimed he could tell how smart someone was by looking at what they drove. He couldn't figure out why anyone would pay a lot of money for something, such as a luxury car, that depreciated in value over time. And if they leased it or borrowed money to buy it, he was really left scratching his head. Russ believed in investing, in assets such as houses or stocks that could appreciate over time. Anything destined to lose money, such as cars, he deemed a liability. "Andrew," he said, "if you can go through life without losing money on cars, you're going to have a huge advantage." He pointed to the guy across the parking lot who worked in management. "You see that guy getting into that BMW? I admired the car when I arrived at work that night. It was a beauty." "He bought that car 2 years ago brand new," Russ said, "but he has already lost $17,000 on it from depreciation and loan interest costs. And in about 3 years, he's probably going to buy another one. I wondered what the car would be worth in 3 years if it had already depreciated so much in just two." "If you're truly wealthy," Russ explained, "then there's nothing wrong with blowing money you can afford to lose on the odd luxury item. But if you're trying to become wealthy," Russ said in a serious tone, "and you make those kinds of purchases, you'll never get there. Never." Russ talked about turning conventional wisdom on its head. Most people expect to lose money on cars, but expecting it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. He told me that people don't have to lose money on cars if they're careful, citing himself as proof. I expected that from someone both financially and mechanically inclined. My biggest question at the time was whether it could work for me, a guy about as mechanically gifted as a blind Neanderthal with two left hands. "When you buy a car," Russ said, "think about the resale value. The bulk of the depreciation on a new vehicle occurs in the first year. Russ recommended I never buy new cars and only buy a car if someone else had covered the bulk of the depreciation." The best resale value, he figured, came from Japanese cars. He recommended that I look for low-mileage models that had been fastidiously maintained with original paint, great tires, and a great interior. If I paid the right price for a car and the bulk of the depreciation was covered by someone else, he preached, I would be able to sell the car a year or two later for the same price I paid, if not a bit more. A Future Millionaire's Car Buying Strategies. Putting Russ's theory to the test, I went out in search of cars that wouldn't put holes in the bottom of my financial bucket. It didn't take me long to get a feel for the market. I read a few consumer reports on reliable automobiles. One invaluable source was Phil Edmonston's annually updated guide, Lemonade Used Cars. Certain cars and models are bona fide lemons, while others can be great little workhorses. I would spend a few minutes each morning looking through the classifieds in the local paper, and when I saw something interesting at a good price, I would check it out. Over the next few years, I bought several low-mileage, reliable Japanese models, paying between $1,500 to $5,000 for a car and driving it for at least 12 months without putting any extra money into it. My cars were cheap, so my profits didn't amount to much, usually $800 to $1,000 a car. Unfortunately, there are too many people who aren't good with their money, and it's often easy to find desperate people who have overextended themselves financially. Buy from them. Generally, they want money quickly, either to upgrade their cars or to pay off oppressively looming debts. I've bought used vehicles from both types of sellers, put as many as 60,000 miles on the cars, and then sold them 2 or 3 years later for the same price I paid. On one occasion, I bought a low-mileage 12-year-old Toyota van for $3,000. I drove it 4,000 miles from British Columbia, Canada, down the Mexican Baja Peninsula, then on to Guadalajara before driving back to Canada. After covering more than 8,000 miles in a single trip, I sold it for $3,500. Using prudent purchasing strategies, you can turn the savings into a small fortune by investing the money in ways that I'll explain later in this book. Here's one surprisingly simple strategy for buying used vehicles that can save you loads of time and money. Imagine wandering onto a car lot. You're not generally given free rein to browse on your own or with a friend. A sharply dressed salesperson will soon be courting you through a variety of makes and models. They could have the very best of intentions, but if you're anything like me, your pulse will race a bit faster as you're shadowed, and the pressure of being shadowed by a slick talker might throw you off. After all, you're on their turf. A minnow, like me, needs an effective strategy against big, hungry, experienced fish. And this is mine. First, I identify exactly what I'm looking for. In 2002, I wanted a Japanese car with a stick shift and original paint. I didn't want a new paint job because I'm not skilled enough to determine whether something had been covered up, such as rust or damage from an accident. I also wanted to ensure that the car had fewer than 80,000 miles on it, and I wanted to pay less than $3,000. It really didn't matter how old the car was, as long as it had been properly maintained and hadn't been around the block too many times. Like a secret agent wrapped up in the bravery of anonymity, I pulled out my hit list from the yellow pages to call every car lot within a 20-mile radius. Sticking to my guns, I told them exactly what I was looking for and wouldn't entertain anything that didn't fit all of my criteria. I did have to hold my ground with aggressive sales staff, but it was a lot easier to do over the telephone than it would have been in person. Most of the dealers told me that they had something I would be interested in, but they couldn't go as low as $3,000. Some tried tempting me into their lairs with alternatives. Others referred to my price ceiling as delusional. But I wasn't bothered. My strategy was a knight sword and the phone my trusty shield. I also practiced chivalry, knowing that I might end up calling on them again. Because my first round of phone calls didn't pan out, I called the dealers back when it got closer to the end of the month. I hoped the salespeople would be hungrier by then to meet their monthly quotas. As fortune would have it, at one dealership, an elderly couple had traded in an older Toyota Tercel with 30,000 miles on it. The car hadn't been cleaned or inspected, but the dealership was willing to do a quick turnaround sale for $3,000. This strategy doesn't have to be limited to a $3,000 purchase. The process makes sense for any make or model, and it saves time. What's more, the money you save can be effectively invested to build wealth. Careful home purchases. Most people realize that expensive automobile purchases can hinder wealth. But the global financial crisis of 2008-2009 taught us important lessons about homes as well. One of the lessons aspiring rich people have to learn is that the banks aren't really their friends. They're out to make money for their shareholders. To do so, they often hire the kindest or most convincing salespeople they can to persuade you to buy lousy investment products, which I'll discuss in Chapter 3, while sugarcoating bloated house loans to keep you paying too many years of interest. What caused the financial crisis of 2008-2009? The greed of the banks not looking after the best interests of their customers, coupled with the ignorance of those who bought homes they couldn't afford. Caught up in the housing boom, buyers purchased homes they couldn't really pay for, and when the dangerously enticing low interest rates finally rose, they couldn't make their mortgage payments. Unsurprisingly, many were forced to sell their homes, creating a surplus in the housing market. When there's a surplus of anything, people aren't willing to pay as much for those items, so they fall in price. Houses were no exception. The banks had sold these mortgage loans to other institutions around the world, but when the original holders of the mortgages, the home purchasers, couldn't afford their mortgage payments, the financial institutions repossessed their houses, but at a significant loss because housing prices were falling like a skydiver without a chute. The banks had also bundled the loans up and sold them to other global institutions, which were then on the hook when the homeowners couldn't pay their mortgages, putting many of the world's most respected financial institutions in peril. With dwindling financial resources, the banks didn't loan as readily to other businesses, which in turn didn't have the funds to cover their day-to-day operations. The snowball effect resulted in a global slowdown and mass layoffs. Don't believe those who sugarcoat housing loans. The effects can be devastating. It reminds me of a lesson my mom taught me when I took out my first mortgage on a piece of oceanfront land. She asked me, if the interest rate doubled, could you still afford to make the payment? According to the terms of the mortgage, I was being charged 7% in interest a year. She knew at the time that a 7% mortgage was historically cheap, especially compared with mortgage rates in the late 1970s and 1980s. As far as she was concerned, if I couldn't afford to pay double, or 14% interest, then rising interest rates could expose me. I would be one of those unfortunate guys caught swimming naked when the tide goes out. Her advice is a good rule of thumb if you don't want to be stripped of your real estate. If you're considering purchasing a home, double the interest rate and figure out if you could still afford the payments. If you can, then you can afford the home. Millionaire handouts. There's a Chinese proverb suggesting that wealth doesn't last more than three generations. There's a generation that builds wealth, a generation that maintains it, and a generation that squanders it. U.S. studies suggest that, contrary to what we might think, most millionaires didn't inherit their wealth. More than 80% of those surveyed are first-generation rich. I teach at a private school in Singapore, where most of the expat students come from affluent families. I tell my students, only half-jokingly, that they're on the financial endangered species list. It's natural for parents to want to help their children. But the Chinese have known for thousands of years what happens to money that's given to youngsters who had no hand in building that wealth. It gets squandered. In Thomas Stanley's classic book, The Millionaire Next Door, he explains that adults who receive helpful financial gifts from their parents, stocks, cash, real estate, typically end up with lower levels of wealth than people in the same income bracket who didn't receive financial assistance. It's a tough concept for many parents to grasp. They feel they can give their kids a strong financial head start by giving them money. Statistically speaking, easy money is wasted money. Stanley studied a broad cross-section of educated professionals in their 40s and 50s, and he categorized them by vocation. Then he split them up into two groups, those who had received financial assistance from their parents and those who hadn't. That assistance included cash gifts, help in paying off loans, help in buying a car, or help with a down payment on a home. He found that those who received help were more likely to have less wealth during their peak earning years than those who had not received financial help from their parents. Receiving financial handouts hinders a person's ability to create wealth. For example, the average accountant who received financial help from his or her parents was 43% less wealthy than an average accountant who didn't receive handouts. In sharp contrast, the only two professional groups studied that became wealthier after receiving financial assistance were school teachers and college professors. How did I become a millionaire? My dad was a mechanic, and I was one of four kids being raised on his salary, so we didn't have a lot of money to throw around when I was growing up. From the age of 15, I bought my own clothes. At 16, I bought my own car with earnings from a part-time job at a supermarket. I had to work for what I wanted, but I didn't enjoy working. Like most kids, I would have preferred hanging out on a beach. So for me, money was equated with work. I would see a desired object costing just $10, but then I would ask myself if I wanted to mop the supermarket floor and stack 50-pound sacks of potatoes to pay for it. If the answer was no, then I wouldn't buy it. Never receiving free money allowed me to adopt responsible spending habits. Confessions of a former cheapskate. Today, my wife and I can afford to live well. We own a classic Mercedes-Benz and a utilitarian Mazda. We travel prolifically, having visited more than 25 different countries. We live in a luxurious condominium with a swimming pool, squash courts, tennis courts, and a weight room. We enjoy massages every week, 52 weeks a year. If our health holds out, we'll enjoy these fruits for the next 40 years. But an early aversion to debt put us in this position. I hate debt. It's going to sound extreme to most people, but for me, owing money is like making a deal with the devil. Always thinking of the worst-case scenario, I would worry what would happen if I lost my job and couldn't meet my debt obligation payments. I'm not recommending that a young person seeking early retirement should live the way I did in my early 20s. But thinking of debt as a life-threatening, contagious disease served me pretty well. Whether you find it inspirational or delusional, I think you'll get a kick out of my story. I began teaching seventh grade a few months after graduating from university. Paying low rent and low food costs, I figured, were like roadmaps to student loan obliteration. Sure, it sounds like a reasonable idea, but there are big city panhandlers who might cringe at my form of minimalism. Potatoes, pasta, and clams were the cheapest forms of sustenance I could find. Clams simply represented free protein. With a bucket in hand, I would wander to the beach with a retired fellow named Oscar, and we would load up on clams. While Oscar turned his catch into delicacies, my efforts were Spartan. Microwave some spuds or boil pasta, and toss in the clams with a bit of olive oil. Voila! Dinner for less than a dollar. It doesn't matter how well you can initially tolerate a bland meal. Keeping that diet up day after day is about as enticing as eating dog food. But my debt burden lessened as I lived on just 30% of my teacher's salary, allowing me to allocate 70% of my salary toward debt reduction. Sharing accommodation with roommates also cut costs. I preferred, however, not paying rent at all, so I looked for people escaping to the Sun Belt for winter and needed someone to look after their homes for the season. No matter how cold the rent-free homes got during the winter, I never turned on the heat. Wanting to keep costs down, I would walk around the house wearing layers of shirts and sweaters while the winter's snow piled up outside. If there was a fireplace, I used it. At night, I would make a roaring fire and then drag blankets in front of it to sleep. Waking up during winter mornings, I often saw my breath. One December week, my father was in town on business, so I invited him to stay with me. Typically boisterous, he was uncharacteristically quiet when I told him, "No, Dad, I'm not going to turn on the heat." I figured that snuggling up together at night next to a fireplace in a frosty living room would be a great father-son bonding moment. I guess he didn't think so. The next time he was in town, he stayed at a hotel. Eventually, I craved the freedom of my own place, so I moved into a basement suite where the landlord charged $350 a month. But low rents can come with inconveniences. In this case, I was a long way from the school where I taught, 35 miles door to door. If I had been smart enough to drive a car to work, it wouldn't have been so bad. I owned a rusting 20-year-old Volkswagen that I bought for $1,200, which I sold 2 years later for $1,800, but I wasn't prepared to pay fuel prices for the 70-mile round-trip commute. So, I rode my bike. Riding an old mountain bike 70 miles a day through rain and sleet on my way to work and back gave me a front-runner's edge for the Bonehead Award. At the time, I had an investment portfolio that would have allowed me to buy a brand new sports car in cash if I'd wanted to, and I could have rented an Oceanside apartment. But the people I worked with probably thought I was broke. One of my fellow teachers saw me at a gas station on my way home from work. We were both picking up fuel, but mine was of the edible kind. Rushing up to me as I straddled my bike and stuffed a power bar into my mouth, she said, "We should really start a collection for you at the school, Andrew." If I thought she was kidding, I would have laughed. After a while, even I decided my lifestyle was a little extreme. To make things easier, I moved closer to work after placing an advertisement in the local paper. Teacher looking for accommodation for no more than $450 a month. It was far below the going rate, but I reasoned an advertisement selling myself as employed and responsible, while leaving out a few other adjectives, might attract someone looking for a dependable tenant. I only got a couple of calls, but one of the places was perfect, so I took it. Because I had been investing money since I was 19, I already had a growing nest egg, but I wasn't willing to sell any of my investments to pay down my loans. I threw every extra income dollar I could toward reducing my student loans. 1 year after working full-time and living like a monk, I paid off my debts. Then I redirected the money enthusiastically into my investments. 6 years after paying off my student loans, I bought a piece of oceanfront property and calculated how to aggressively pay down the mortgage. I even took a higher interest rate to increase my flexibility of mortgage payments. Once I paid it off, I shoveled money once again into my investments. Admittedly, few people despise debt as much as I do. But once you're debt-free, there's no feeling like it. Don't get me wrong, this part of my financial history isn't a how-to manual for a young person to follow. It was a fun challenge at the time, but it wouldn't appeal to me today. And my wife, who I married much later, admits it wouldn't have appealed to her ever. That said, if you want to be wealthy, you dramatically increase your odds if you're frugal, especially when you're young. Looking to the future. Responsible spending habits are often overlooked by people who want to be rich. It's one of the reasons many people nearing retirement age have to work when they would rather be traveling the world or spending time with their grandchildren. Naturally, not everyone has the same philosophy about work, but how many people on their deathbeds ever lament, "Gosh, I wish I had spent more time at the office," or "Geez, I really wish they had given me that promotion back in 2015. Most people prefer their hobbies to their workplace, their children to their Blackberries, and their quiet, reflective moments to their office meetings. I'm certainly among them, which is the reason I learned to control my spending and invest my money effectively. If you're a young person starting out and you see someone with the latest expensive toys, think about how they might have acquired them. Too many of those items were probably bought on credit, with sleepless nights as a complimentary accessory. Many of those people will never truly be rich. Instead, they will be stressed. By learning how to spend like a rich person, you can eventually build wealth and material possessions without the added anxiety. You don't have to live like a pauper to do it either. apply the investment rules that I'm willing to share, and you could feasibly invest half of what your neighbor does, take lower risks, and still end up with twice as much money as they do. Read on to find out how. Rule 2. Use the greatest investment ally you have. So much of what schools teach in a traditional mathematics class is, let me word this diplomatically, not likely to affect our day-to-day lives. Sure, learning the formulas for quadratic equations and their abstract family members might jazz the odd engineering student. But let's be honest, few people get aroused by quadratic equations. Perhaps I'm committing heresy in the eyes of the world's math teachers, but I think quadratic equations, a polynomial equation of the second degree, if that clears things up, are about as useful to most people as ingrown toenails and just as painful for some. Having said that, buried in the dull pages of most school math books is something that's actually useful: the magical premise of compound interest. Warren Buffett applied it to become a billionaire. More importantly, so can you, and I'll show you how. Buffett has long jockeyed with Microsoft chairman Bill Gates for the title of world's richest man. He lives like a typical millionaire. He doesn't spend much on material things, and he mastered the secret of investing his money early. He bought his first stock when he was 11 years old, and the multi-billionaire jokes that he started too late. Starting early is the greatest gift you can give yourself. If you start early, and if you invest efficiently, in a manner that I'll explain in this book, you can build a fortune over time while spending just 60 minutes a year monitoring your investments. Warren Buffett famously quips, "Preparation is everything. Noah did not start building the ark when it was raining." Most of us are aware of the biblical story about Noah's ark. God told him to build an ark and to collect a variety of animals, and eventually, when the rains came, they would sail off to a new beginning. Luckily for the animals, Noah started building that ark right away. He didn't procrastinate. But let's imagine Noah for a second. The guy probably had a similar nature to you and me, so even if God told him to keep the upcoming flood a secret, he might not have. After all, he was human too. So I can imagine him wandering down to the local watering hole and, after having a couple of forerunners to Budweiser beer, whispering to a friend, "Hey, listen, God is saying that the rains are going to come and that I have to build an ark and sail away once the land is flooded." Some of his buddies, maybe even all of them, might have figured Noah had accidentally eaten some kind of naturally grown narcotic. A crazy story, they would think. Yet someone must have believed him. As far-fetched as Noah's flood story might have sounded to his buddies, it would have inspired at least one of his friends to build his own ark, or at least a decent-sized boat. Despite the best of intentions, though, that person obviously never got around to it. Maybe he planned to build it when he acquired more money to pay for the materials. Maybe he wanted to be sure, waiting to see if the clouds grew dark and it started sprinkling. English naturalist Charles Darwin might call this guy's procrastination natural selection. Needless to say, he wasn't selected. For the best odds of amassing wealth in the stock and bond markets, it's best to start early. Thankfully, your friends, if they procrastinate, won't meet the same fate as Noah's friends, but your metaphorical ship will sail off into the distance while others scramble in the rain to assemble their own boats. Starting early is more than just getting a head start. It's about using magic. You can sail away slowly, and your friends can come after you with racing boats. But thanks to the force described by Albert Einstein, some say, as more powerful than splitting the atom, they aren't likely to catch you. In William Shakespeare's Hamlet, the protagonist says to his friend, "There are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamt of in your philosophy." Hamlet was referring to ghosts. Einstein was referring to the magic of compound interest. Compound interest, the world's most powerful financial concept. Compound interest might sound like a complicated process, but it's simple. If $100 attracts 10% interest in 1 year, then we know that it gained $10, turning $100 into $110. You would start the second year with $110, and if it increases 10%, it would gain $11, turning $110 into $121. You will go into the third year with $121 in your pocket, and if it increases 10%, it would gain $12.10, turning $121 into $133.10. It isn't long before a snowball effect takes place. Have a look at what $100 invested at 10% annually can do. $100 at 10% compounding interest a year turns into $161.05 after 5 years. $259.37 after 10 years, $417.72 after 15 years, $672.74 after 20 years, $1,744.94 after 30 years, $4,525.92 after 40 years, $11,739.08 after 50 years, $78,974.69 after 70 years. $204,840.02 after 80 years. $1,378,061.23 after 100 years. Some of the lengthier periods above might look dramatically unrealistic, but you don't have to be a creepy, ageless character in the Twilight series to benefit. Someone who starts investing at 19, like I did, and who lives until they're 90, which I hope to, will have money compounding in the markets for 71 years. They will spend some of it along the way, but they'll always want to keep a portion of their money compounding in case they live to 100. The inspirational realities of starting early. After paying off your high-interest loans, whether they are car loans or credit card loans, you will be ready to put Buffett's NOAA principle to work. The earlier you start, the better. So if you're 18 years old, start now. If you're 50 years old and you haven't begun, there's no better time than the present. You'll never be younger than you are right now. The money that doesn't go toward expensive cars, the latest tech gadgets, and credit card payments, assuming you have paid off your credit debts, can compound dramatically in the stock market if you're patient. And the longer your money is invested in the stock market, the lower the risk. We know that stock markets can fluctuate dramatically. They can even move sideways for many years. But over the past 90 years, the U.S. stock market has generated returns exceeding 9% annually. This includes the crashes of 1929, 1973, 1974, 1987, and 2008-2009. In stocks for the long run, University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School finance professor Jeremy Siegel suggests a dominant historical market, such as the U.S., isn't the only source of impressive long-term returns. Despite the shrinking global importance of England, its stock market returns since 1926 have been very similar to that of the U.S. Meanwhile, not even two devastating world wars for Germany have hurt its long-term stock market performance, which also rivals that of the United States. My suggestion isn't going to be to choose one country's stock market over another. Some stock markets will do better than others, but without mythical crystal balls, we're not going to know ahead of time. Instead, to ensure the best chances of success, owning an interest in all of the world's stock markets is a good idea. And you can benefit exponentially by investing as early as you can. The younger you are when you start investing, the better. Grow wealthier than your neighbor while investing less. The question below showcases how powerful the NOAA principle of starting early really is. A. Would you rather invest $32,400 and turn it into $1,050,180, or B. Would you rather invest $240,000 and turn it into $813,128? Sure, it's a dumb question. Anyone who can fog a mirror would choose A. But because most people haven't had a strong financial education, the vast majority would be lucky to face scenario B, never mind scenario A. If you know anyone who's really young, they can benefit from your knowledge. they can feasibly turn $32,400 into more than $1 million. But don't weaken them by giving them money. Make them earn it. Here's how it can be done. The Bohemian Millionaire, the best of historical-based fiction. A 5-year-old girl named Star is raised by her mother, Autumn, and brought up on a Bohemian island where the locals make their own clothes, where neither men nor women use razors to shave, and where no one tries to mask the aphrodisiac quality of good old-fashioned sweat. Unfortunately, despite how appealing this might sound, especially at tightly congested town hall meetings, it isn't paradise. Islanders and locals alike often throw empty aluminum beverage cans into ditches. Autumn convinces Star that collecting those cans and recycling them can help the environment and eventually make her a millionaire. Autumn takes Star to the local recycling depot, where Star collects an average of $1.45 a day from refunded cans and bottles. Although a bohemian at heart, Autumn's no provincial bumpkin. She recognizes that if she persuades Star to earn $1.45 a day from can returns, she can invest the daily $1.45 to make Star a millionaire. Putting it into the U.S. stock market, Star earns an average of 9% a year, which is slightly less than what the stock market has averaged over the past 90 years. Autumn also understands what most parents do not. If she teaches Star to save, her daughter will become a financial powerhouse. But if she gifts Star money rather than coaching her to earn it, then her daughter may become financially inept. Fast forward 20 years. Star is now 25 years old, and although she no longer collects cans from ditches, her mother insists Star sends her a $45 monthly check, roughly $1.45 per day. Autumn continues to invest Star's money while Star hawks her handmade dream catchers at the local farmer's market. Living in New York City, Star's best friend Lucy works as an investment banker. I know you're wondering how these two hooked up, but roll with it. It's my story. Living the good life, Lucy drives a BMW, dines at gourmet restaurants, and blows the rest of her significant income on clothing, theater shows, expensive shoes, and flashy jewelry. At age 40, Lucy begins to save $800 a month, and she gets on Star's case via email about Star's limited $45 a month contribution to her financial future. Star doesn't want to brag, but she needs to set Lucy straight. "Lucy," she writes, "you're the one in financial trouble, not me. It's true that you're investing far more money than I am, but you'll need to invest more than $800 a month if you want as much as I'll have when I retire." The email puzzles Lucy, who assumes that Star must have ingested some very bohemian mushrooms to write such cryptic nonsense. 25 years later, both women are 65 years old, and they decide to rent a retirement home together in Lake Chapala, Mexico, where their money would go a lot further. "Well," inquires Star, "did you invest more than $800 a month like I suggested?" "This is coming from someone investing $45 a month?" asks Lucy with surprise. "But Lucy, you ignored the Noah principle, so despite investing far more money, you ended up with a lot less than I did because you started investing so much later." Both women achieved the same return in the stock market. Some years they gained money, other years they lost money, but overall, they each averaged 9%. Figure 2.1 shows that because Star started early, she was able to invest a total of $32,400 and turn it into more than $1 million. Lucy started later, investing nearly 8 times more, but ended up with $237,052 less than Star. "I didn't start investing until I was 19, so Star would have had the jump on me. But I started far earlier than most, so I have had more time to let the Noah principle work its magic. I put money in U.S. and international stock markets that, from 1990 to 2011, have averaged more than 10% annually. The money I put in the market in 1990 is now 7 times its original value." When I tell young parents about the power of compounding money, they're often inspired to set aside money for their children's future. Setting aside money for a child, however, is very different from encouraging a child to earn, save, and invest. Giving money promotes weakness and dependence. Teaching money lessons and cheerleading the struggle promotes strength, independence, and pride. Gifting money to yourself. In 2005, I was having dinner with a couple of school teachers, and the topic of savings came up. They wanted to know how much they should save for their retirement. Unlike most public school teachers who can look forward to pensions when they retire, these friends are in the same boat that I'm in. As private school teachers, they're responsible for their own retirement money. I threw out a minimum dollar figure that I thought they should save each month. It was double what they were currently saving. The woman, who I'll call Julie, thought it was an attainable amount. Her husband, who I'll call Tom, thought it was crazy. So I asked them to do a couple of things. 1. Write down everything they spent money on for 3 months, including food costs, mortgage costs, gas for the car, and health insurance. 2. At the end of those 3 months, figure out what it cost them to live each month. The next time we had dinner together, they told me their results, which had given them both a jolt. Julie was surprised at how much she was spending on eating out, buying clothes, and purchasing small items such as Starbucks coffee. Tom was surprised at how much he was spending on beers at the clubhouse when he went golfing with his buddies. As the 3 month period progressed, an awakening took place. Pulling receipts from their wallets and writing down their expenses each evening made them realize how much they were squandering. As Tom explained, I knew that I had to write those purchases down at the end of the day, which acted as an accountability measurement, so I started spending less. Financially efficient households know what their costs are. By writing down expenses, two things generally occur. You get an idea of how much you spend in a month, providing an idea of how much you can invest. It also makes you accountable for your spending, which encourages most people to cut back. The next step is to figure out exactly what you get paid in the average month. When you subtract your average monthly expense costs from your income, you can get an idea of how much you can afford to invest. Don't wait until the end of the month to invest that money. Instead, make the transfer payment to your investment of choice on the day you get paid. Otherwise, you might not have enough left at the end of the month, after a few too many nights out, to follow through with your new financial plan. My wife made that mistake before we were married, investing whatever amount she had left in her account at the end of the month or the end of the year. When she switched things around and automatically had money transferred from her savings account on the date she was paid, she ended up investing twice as much. My friends Julie and Tom had the same realization. After a year, they had doubled the amount that they were investing. 2 years later, when the same conversation came up, I found they had tripled the amount they were originally putting away. Both said the same thing. We didn't know where that money was going each month. It doesn't feel like we live any differently than we did 3 years ago, but the deposits in our investment account don't lie. We've tripled our savings. After a while, you probably won't have to write down every penny you spend. You'll fall into a healthy spending pattern, and the money that gets transferred automatically to your investment account can grow over time. Here's another useful tip. Over the years, your salary will most likely rise. If it increases by $1,000 in a given year, add at least half of it to your investment account while putting the rest in a separate account for something special. That way, you'll get rewarded twice for the salary increase. When you definitely shouldn't invest. Before getting wrapped up in how much money you can save and invest, there's one very important thing you need to clear up. Are you paying interest on credit cards? If you are, then it makes no financial sense to invest money. Most credit cards charge 18 to 24% in interest annually. Not paying them off in full at the end of the month means that your friendly card company, the one you'll never leave home without, is sucking your money from an intravenous drip attached to your femoral artery. You don't have to be smarter than a fifth grader to realize that paying 18% interest on credit card debt and investing money that you hope will provide returns of 10% makes as much sense as bathing fully clothed in a giant tub of Vaseline and then traveling home on the roof of a bus. Paying off credit card debt that's charging 18% in interest is like making a tax-free 18% gain on your money. and there's no way that your investments can guarantee a gain like that after tax. If any financial advisor, advertisement, or investment group of any kind promises a return of 18% annually, think of disgraced U.S. financier Bernie Madoff and run. Nobody can guarantee those kinds of returns. Well, nobody except the credit card companies. They're making 18 to 24% annually from you if you carry a balance, not for you. How and why stocks rise in value. You might be wondering how I averaged 10% a year on the stock market for 20 years. There were